Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Kashyapin Vishyapin Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadara Shri Vasadi Gaurabhaktivinoda. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Thank you for allowing me to serve the Srimad Bhagavatam today. Today we are reading Canto 3, Chapter 5, Text 3. The title of the chapter is Vidura's Talks with Maitreya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam namaskritya,
Narayanam namaskritya,
Naram chaiva narottamam,
Naram chaiva narottamam,
Devim sarasvatim vyasam,
Devim sarasvatim vyasam,
Tato jaya mudirayat,
Tato jaya mudirayat,
Nashta praeshu abhadreshu,
Nashta praeshu abhadreshu,
Nityam bhagavata sevaya,
Nityam bhagavata sevaya,
Bhagavati uttama shloke, Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtiki. Text 3. Janasya Krishna Vimukasya Daivad.
Janasya Krishna Vimukasya Daivad.
Adharma Shivasya Sudukitasya. Anugrahayeha charanti nunam.
Anugrahayeha charanti nunam.
Bhutani bhavyani janardanasya.
Bhutani bhavyani janardanasya.
Janasya krishna vimukasya daivad.
Janasya krishna vimukasya daivad.
Adharma shivasya sudukitasya. Anugrahayeha charanti nunam.
Anugrahayeha charanti nunam.
Bhutani bhavyani janardanasya.
Bhutani bhavyani janardanasya.
Please chant.
Janasya Krishna vimukasya daiva.
Janasya Krishna vimukasya daiva. Janasya Krishna Vimukasya Daiva.
Adharma Shilasya Sudukitasya.
Adharma Shilasya Sudukitasya.
Anugrahayeha Charanti Nunam.
Anugrahayeha Charanti Nunam.
Bhutani Bhavyani Janardanasya.
Bhutani Bhavyani Janardanasya. Janasya Krishna Vimukasya Daiva.
Adharma
Shilasya Sudukitasya.
Anugrahayeha Charanti Nunam.
Bhutani Bhavyani Janardanasya. Synonyms? Janasya,
of the common man.
Krishnat,
from the Supreme Lord Krishna.
Vimukasya,
of the one who has turned his face against the Lord.
Daivat,
by the influence of external energy. Adharma
Shivasya.
Of one who is engaged in irreligion. Sudukitasya. Of one who is always unhappy. Anugrahaya. Due to being compassionate towards them. Iha. In this world. Charanti. Wander. Nuna. Certainly. Bhutani. Persons. Bhavyani. Great philanthropic souls. Janardanasya. Of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. This is Vidura speaking to Maitreya. Oh my Lord, great philanthropic souls travel on the earth on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead to show compassion to the fallen souls who are averse to the sense of subordination of the Lord. Please repeat, oh my Lord.
Great philanthropic souls
travel on the earth on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead to show compassion to the fallen souls who are averse to the sense of subordination to the Lord. Report by Srila Prabhupada. To be obedient to the wishes of the Supreme Lord is the natural position of every living entity. But due only to past misdeeds, a living being becomes averse to the sense of subordination to the Lord and suffers all the miseries of material existence. No one has anything to do but render devotional service to the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna. Therefore, any activity other than transcendental loving service to the Lord is more or less a rebellious action against the Supreme Will. All fruit of activity, empirical philosophy, and mysticism are more or less against the sense of subordination to the Lord, and any living entity engaged in such rebellious activity is more or less condemned by the laws of material nature, which work under the subordination of the Lord. Great unalloyed devotees of the Lord are compassionate towards the fallen, and therefore they travel all over the world with the mission of bringing souls back to Godhead, back to home. Such pure devotees of the Lord carry the message of Godhead in order to deliver the fallen souls, and therefore the common man who is bewildered by the influence of the external energy of the Lord should avail himself of their association. So this is a continuation from the previous verse where Vidura was inquiring from Maitreya, a very appropriate question for everyone. What is the right way to live for happiness since everyone is engaged in fruitive activities, which brings him neither satiation nor mitigation of the stress? What is the right way to live for happiness since everyone is engaged in fruitive activities? These activities don't bring them satiation or mitigation of the stress. I'm sure we can all relate to that. And then in that purport from the prior verse, Prabhupada says, fruitive worker is not happy in his schemes, nor is there any satiation of his continuous hankering for happiness. Well, that's a very appropriate question for the people of this world who are, most of them are engaged just in fruitive activities and they don't know anything else. And so these great philanthropic souls from today's shloka, they travel this earth out of compassion to show these conditioned jiva souls who are bewildered and who don't know anything else but performing fruitive activities. They travel the earth with compassion, trying to show them like there's another way. There's something more than just this fruit of activities and this, you're trying to be happy, but you cannot achieve that happiness. So. A common man cannot understand the Lord. He must first know the real position of his life under the influence of the illusory energy. He must first know his real position under the influence of illusory energy. So I would say that most people don't understand their position under the influence of the illusory energy. Only we who have gotten this information from Srila Prabhupada and other great philanthropic souls can understand the position under the illusory energy. In this illusion, one thinks that he can be happy only by fruitive activities. But what actually happens is that one becomes more and more entangled in actions and reactions and does not find any solution to the problems of life. They think they can be happy because they are. Why do they think they can be happy? Can anyone say why? Why do they think that?
What else?
Right. They don't know anything else. They're under the illusory energy and they're bewildered by it, and they just think that that's a program. So they're trying to achieve happiness, but they're not successful. And Prabhupada says in today's purport, those who are under the illusory energy, there's a few different types, all fruitive activity, empirical philosophy, and mysticism are more or less against the subordination of the Lord. And any living entity engaged in such rebellious activity is more or less condemned by the laws of material nature, which work under the subordination of the Lord. So all fruitive activity, all empirical philosophy, and all mysticism are against the subordination of the Lord. And Prabhupada calls this a rebellious activities. And because of their position, they are condemned by the laws of material nature. So what does this mean, condemned by the laws of material nature? Would anybody like to say? What is it to be condemned by the laws of material nature?
It will suffer.
It will suffer, yes. Yes. They will perform some action under this illusory energy, and they will get a reaction for that action.
Can say it. We are also looking for the same freedom that they are looking for. But in connection with Krishna, our freedom is maintained. Actually, we do become complete, free from demons. And they don't get it. That's why Prabhupada is using the heavy word on them.
That's a nice point. Yes, they're due to ignorance. They're trying. It's like, this is the only way I know how. I'm looking for happiness. And because this is the only way I know how, I'm trying to find this happiness. And the program is that they're condemned. And they have to take birth after birth. They have to get karmic reactions. And they have to come back, possibly, most likely get degraded in the next birth, because most of them are, you know, performing sinful activities, but they're not even aware of them. So this is what it means to be condemned, and it's out of ignorance. And these great philanthropic souls come to enlighten. For those who are ready to take the message. So basically the question is, how do we get out of this illusory energy in which Prabhupada says the jiva is tightly bound? And we get the answer in Bhagavad Gita 7:14. Dagadhiya shagunamai mama maya duratyaya mamevaya prapadyante mayametam tarantite. This divine energy of mine consisting of the three modes of material nature is difficult to overcome, but those who have surrendered onto me can easily cross beyond it. And then in the purport, Prabhupada says that one has to be pulled out by one who is liberated. The conditioned soul is tightly bound by the ropes of illusion. A man bound by the hands and feet cannot free himself. He must be helped by a person who is unbound. Because the bound cannot help the bound, the rescuer must be liberated. Therefore, only Lord Krishna or his bona fide representative can release the conditioned soul. Without such superior help, one cannot be freed from the bondage of material nature. So, he must be helped by a person who is unbound, because this illusory energy holds him like a rope. Because the bound cannot help the bound, the rescuer must be liberated. And so these liberated souls come to try to pull these bound conditioned souls out of the illusory energy and get them to surrender to Krishna, and that is the only way that they can overcome it. It is a conditioned soul, this is from Sri Upanishad, it is a conditioned soul who tries to dominate material nature and is instead subjected to the laws of material nature and the sufferings of repeated birth and death. The Lord, or his representative, the great philanthropic souls, come here to reestablish the principles of religion, and the basic principle is the development of an attitude of surrender to him. This is the Lord's instruction in Bhagavad Gita. Sravadharmam parityaja manekam sharanam vrajaham. Give up all other processes and just surrender to me. So by this process of surrender, you can overcome this illusory energy, and he must be pulled out by someone who is unbound. And basically the people are asleep in this illusory energy. And they have to come, the soul, the great philanthropic souls have to come and they have to try to wake them up. In the Udila Arana song by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, which we sing often, and all the devotees chant the names of Mukunda, Madhava, Yadava, and Hari, their mouths being filled with the vibrations. They would announce to the still sleeping people, you spend your nights uselessly sleeping and your days decorating your bodies. You've achieved such a rare human body, but you do not care for this gift. You remain not serving the Dharma of Yashoda and slowly fall through your last moments to death. And basically, without this higher knowledge and without the help of these great philanthropic souls, the jiva is in ignorance, as we said, and he's comfortable in his ignorance. He has the illusion of being comfortable. He doesn't see a problem with it. He doesn't see like bad things are coming. That's what it means to be under the illusory energy. Consequently, he's continuously making plans to live here peacefully and happily. I'm sure we all know people like that. One example of this trying to live here peacefully and happily, but the material laws are taking place, was in 1980, the Mount St. Helens mountain, which is a volcano, erupted in a huge way. It hadn't erupted in over 100 years, and the people of that area were very comfortable in that area, even though they knew it was a volcano. You know, they were just comfortable. They were living their lives. It was populated all around the volcano. It hadn't exploded for many, many years, like over 100 years. And, you know, they didn't think it was possible that it could explode. Or if it did explode, it wouldn't be, like, so bad. So the volcano in 1980, it gave them, like, a warning. It was for 2 months prior to the big eruption. It started to, like, give little eruptions, and there was many geologists, volcanologists, the scientists were like issuing warnings, like it seems like something huge is gonna happen here. And the volcano was giving everyone a warning for about 2 months, and the side of the mountain started to like even bubble up and started to grow like a certain amount of feet every day. And still many people, I saw documentaries on this, many people were like comfortable, you know, they didn't think it's gonna affect them. I have my house here, I have my life, it hasn't exploded in many years. You know, I don't think it's gonna be that big a deal. I might evacuate, I might not, you know. They didn't take it like too seriously, because they're trying to make plans to be happy in this material world, and under that illusory energy, they didn't think that anything bad could happen. Around this mountain, which is very beautiful, Mount St. Helens in Washington State. It was a very, very beautiful place. Many people will go hiking and camping. And that was still okay, but then because there was like lots of good trees and timber, there was also like lots of industry starting to happen. There was lots of timber and like mining for minerals, and also hunting and fishing, which all these things are like sinful activities. And so eventually, you know, condemned by the laws of material nature, there was some reaction that had to happen. So these people were comfortable in their little life under this beautiful mountain, with their houses and their lives and their plans. And they didn't take it too seriously, and the mountain gave them 2 months' warning. And then, in May of 1980, it was a huge explosion. They even like predicted it down to the day, the scientists. And basically, the whole side of the mountain exploded. Usually a volcano erupts like upwards from the top, and so it's not like too much damage, but this one was so huge that it exploded laterally. And the whole like side of the mountain exploded like to the side, and it was like very, very destructive for that reason. Because it exploded like from the side and damaged like so many miles around. It spewed like 12 miles into air. Ash landed in 11 states, leveled houses and bridges in a huge radius, caused floods and like just massive, massive destruction. So this is what it means to be. The force of the explosion was 1,500 Hiroshima bombs. So this is what it means to be comfortable in that illusory energy, and yet there's like sinful activities going on. There was like timber going, like they were harvesting timber, which is, you know, that's a sinful activity. Not supposed to cut down trees like that. They were like mining for minerals, like that's a sinful activity. Hunting, fishing, those are all sinful activities, and eventually they got a reaction. So I hope that was like a good illustration of that principle. And recently we read in the CC, because he wants to enjoy the material energy, the conditioned soul is allowed to reside in Devi Dham, the external energy, where Goddess Durga carries out the orders of the Supreme Lord as his maidservant. For material facilities, the conditioned soul tries to please Goddess Durga, and Mother Durga supplies all kinds of material facilities. Because of this, the conditioned souls are allured and do not wish to leave the external energy. Consequently, they are continuously making plans to live here peacefully and happily. Because Mother Durga supplies all kinds of material facilities, the conditioned souls are allured and do not wish to leave the external energy. Consequently, they are continuously making plans to live here peacefully and happily. Such is the material world. Sometimes even if people do get this knowledge, they are simply not interested. In the purport to Bhagavad Gita 7.3, there are various grades of men, and out of many thousands, one may be sufficiently interested in transcendental realization to try to know what is the self, what is the body, and what is the absolute truth. Generally, mankind is simply engaged in animal propensities, namely eating, sleeping, defending, and mating, and hardly anyone is interested in transcendental knowledge. Prabhupada, there are various grades of men, and out of many thousands, one may be sufficiently interested in transcendental knowledge. Generally, they're only interested in eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. And furthermore, the whole society is structured in such a way that this highest knowledge, this Raja Vidya, this king of knowledge, is not readily taught or available. There are so many departments of knowledge all over the world and many huge universities, but there is unfortunately no university or educational institution where the science of the spirit soul is instructed. Yet the soul is the most important part of the body. Without the presence of the soul, the body has no value. Still, people are placing great stress on the bodily necessities of life, not caring for the vital soul. And yet this advancement of this material civilization is simply based on this process of sense gratification and fruitive activity. And not that all sense gratification is a bad thing, if it's done in a dharmic way, in some sense gratification. But if sense gratification is one's all in all, then one simply gets condemned by material energy. And we see that the people out there, they are advancing civilization, basically based only on sense gratification and creative activity. Mm. And so what's the problem with trying to only gratify the senses? Not saying we shouldn't gratify the senses at all, but if one is only trying to gratify the senses, what is the problem with that? The problem is they can never be fully satisfied. Living entities, pure consciousness, becomes covered by his eternal enemy lust, which is never satisfied and which burns like fire. So we've often heard this metaphor of this material existence being like a blazing fire, which can only be put out by a liberated soul and this transcendental knowledge. So in the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada presents four types of these people who try to just live for the senses and fruitive activity as all in all, and basically going against this plan of surrendering to the Lord, which is the only auspicious path for the jiva. And he calls these, he breaks them down into four categories. He calls them miscreants, dushkritanas, because they are atheistic plan makers and they want to try to make life better out of ignorance. And as a result, they cannot accept the plan of the Lord. And ultimately they fail. But they don't think it's going to fail. Mm. The materialist wrongly thinks that there is no creator other than his own self. This is called maya, or illusion. Because of his poor fund of knowledge, the materialist cannot see beyond the purview of his imperfect senses. This is the maya, this is the illusion. Because of his poor fund of knowledge, the materialist cannot see beyond the purview of his imperfect senses. And thus he thinks that matter automatically takes its own shape without the aid of superior intelligence. Under illusion and the modes of passion and ignorance, all his plans are baffled, as in the case of Hiranyakashipu and Ravana, whose plans were smashed to dust, although they were both materially learned as scientists, philosophers, administrators, and educators. So we know so many great personalities in history who maybe were wonderful and amazing in a material sense, but what happened to them? They were simply condemned by the laws of material nature. They left this planet and were most likely degraded in the next birth. So that's all. That's all that can happen to you if you're only an atheistic plan maker, only trying to make life better out of, from a sense of creative activities and sense gratification. Mm. And from the Sri Upanishad, one must know perfectly, side by side, Sambhuti, the personality of Godhead, and Vinasha, the temporary material manifestation, side by side. By knowing the material manifestation alone, one cannot be saved, for in the course of nature, there is devastation at every moment. Nor can one be saved from these devastations by the opening of hospitals. One can be saved only by complete knowledge of eternal life, of bliss and awareness. One can be saved only by complete knowledge of eternal life, of bliss, and awareness. The whole Vedic scheme is meant to educate men in this art of attaining eternal life. So once a jiva soul is ready, or by causeless mercy, he gets this information. And what causes him to surrender is when he learns about the personality of Godhead, and he learns of his qualities and his opulences, and then he understands that Krishna is all in all, and he's the cause of all causes and is the source of everything. And by this knowledge, he surrenders to him. Mm. And how do we learn of Krishna's opulences? By Srila Prabhupada's books. So for us, he was the great philanthropic soul who brought us this knowledge. And now we have his books as well. We learned of Krishna's opulence, and we surrendered. In Bhagavad Gita, 10th chapter, I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wise who perfectly know this engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts. Tam sarvasya prabhavo mata sarvam pravartate iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhava samamitaham. One who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mine engages in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. When one factually knows the opulence of the Supreme, there is no alternative but to surrender to him. This factual knowledge can be known from the descriptions of Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, and similar literatures. So I wanted to ask if anybody would like to share, or maybe the new Baptists, since they're recently new, if there's some quality that you learned from Prabhupada's books about Krishna, or about the Absolute Truth, that caused you to realize, like, yes, this is what I have to surrender to. This is why I need to surrender. Is there some quality or some shloka that you learned that caused you to understand the importance of surrender, or major desire to surrender?
I think I understand better through Prabhupada's teachings the importance of the time, like what I have today and tomorrow will come. We can make a distinction here between a comparison. The jivas who are after sense gratification, and those who are trying to make advancement. I guess we're doing it like similarly, in the same way. They're looking for tomorrow, and that's why they condemn, according to the scriptures, I'm sure, because tomorrow is coming. Things not working out today. Tomorrow it will be better for me.
Yes.
You know, I can make plans for tomorrow. Yes. And in this way they are condemned. Because they're using this precious gift called tomorrow,
yes,
time, for this purpose of sense grab. It has nothing to do with the absolute aim of life.
Yes. As you were saying, it's under their ignorance. Yes. Yes.
And for us as well, who are trying to make spiritual advancement, we're looking forward to tomorrow so we can do better. We can improve.
Yes.
Become closer.
In Krishna consciousness.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So we're all looking for better, but in different ways.
Yes, that's a nice point. Mm-hmm. Anyone else want to share, like, what made you realize, like, I need to surrender to Krishna, to this process, or Prabhupada, any particular thing?
Srila Prabhupada mentioned many times in his lecture about this formula. But then I was reading yesterday a little more on that, and I'm trying to collect all Prabhupada's lecture. So one place Prabhupada says, he cares for each soul. Nobody can do what he does. He always looking for always looking to uplift the consciousness of the soul, always looking for better facility for the soul to come back home. So somebody like mother, more than mother, never stop, keep
yes
on going just to bring back. Such a nice quality. Right? Of course I should be also greedy to go back, not just focus on.
And no one cares for us that much. Very nice. After Arjuna witnesses Krishna's universal form in the 11th chapter of the Gita, After hearing these words from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the trembling Arjuna offered obeisances with folded hands again and again. He fearfully spoke to Lord Krishna in a faltering voice. O Master of the senses, the world becomes joyful upon hearing your name, and thus everyone becomes attached to you. Although the perfected beings offer you their respectful homage, the demons are afraid and they flee here and there. All this is rightly done. O Great One, greater even than Brahma, you are the original creator. Why then should they not offer their respectful obeisances unto you? O Limitless One, God of gods, refuge of the universe, you are the invincible source, the cause of all causes, transcendental to this material manifestation. You are the original personality of Godhead, the oldest, the ultimate sanctuary of this manifested cosmic world. You are the knower of everything, and you are all that is knowable. You are the supreme refuge above the material modes, a limitless form. This whole cosmic manifestation is pervaded by you. He surrenders to Krishna. You can see if there's any questions or anything you want to add. I have just a little bit more. I was going to talk a little bit more about one of these great philanthropic souls. See if there's any other discussion points or additions. Yes, I never got one.
So it seems that knowledge is one thing, to have the knowledge of the grandeur of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but yet still that false ego prevents one from surrendering.
Nice point.
So it seems that false ego that says, I can do better, I can just make things work next time, or, you know, yeah, because they're not materially exhausted.
That's a nice point.
So it seems that that factor has to also play in. Also regarding this place, Krishna certifies this material world as dukkhalayam, a place of suffering. One time someone said, just like the Himalaya, Himalaya means a place of ice or cold. So no one would go to the Himalayas to go sunbathing. That's like crazy, you know, totally. So yet we come to this material world and it's a place of suffering and we're expecting happiness.
That's a really nice point, yeah. And speaking of the Himalayas, sort of to add to your point, there's a bunch of mountains in Asia who they're above like 8,000 meters, and anything above 8,000 meters is called a death zone because there's not enough oxygen for the organism to survive. So there's 14 such peaks in the world. They're all in Asia, mostly in the Himalayas. So anything about 8,000 feet is the death zone. But yet people are clamoring to climb these mountains, like, you know, like mountaineers. And so many of them die on these mountains. But they're still, like, going. And they can't keep up with the permits of, like, the governments, you know, they're, like, can't issue as many permits as the people would like, and there's like a queue now to climb Everest. You know, and there's dead bodies like littered on Everest because they just remain like frozen. Right, that's what I mean. Yeah, exactly what you're saying. Or like some search for like adrenaline, like happiness in the form of adrenaline. And the most dangerous mountain is actually K2, which is in Pakistan. It's more dangerous than the Himalayas, more dangerous than Everest. It's not as high as Everest, but it's the most dangerous, and it's one of the... K2? Not K2.
Like, K2 is
the
death planet also.
No, not K2, like K, the letter K, and the number 2, K2.
No, but I was thinking it's interesting
that
name is K2 because it's actually...
It could be, yeah. And so the death rate on K2 is 1 out of 4. For those to try to summit.
Well, what is
Why?
How?
Oh, okay, well, for many different reasons. One is that it's above 8,000 meters. And any mountain above 8,000 meters is called a death zone. They don't have enough oxygen. for the body to survive. They have to try to climb with oxygen masks, but even with that, it's like not enough. But then other things also is the mountains have their own weather at that elevation. And it could be like perfectly sunny out, and then all of a sudden a storm could just come and, you know, just wipe them. If they fall, if they just fall off the mountain, they're dead. Like, they can't fall. So there's many ways they could die. They could get like brain swelling, edema. They could get like pulmonary swelling. There's like a variety of ways they could die. So one out of four on K2 that tries to summit dies. Like that's the death rate. And Everest is like 1 out of 100. It's like less than Everest. Because this K2 is like extremely steep and it has its own weather. Like the weather is horribly unpredictable. But still, the government of Pakistan, they cannot issue, they have to like, no, we can't issue these permits. The people are clamoring to climb it. Like, so, no, I don't personally understand that, but that's that, you know, being under that illusory energy or adrenaline or trying to think they can find some happiness in this world of Pratishta. I don't know. I don't get that. Does anyone get that? Like, yes, they're trying to conquer nature, yes.
Yeah, I think that's a point.
Yes.
We
because they want to lord it over, I guess.
Yes. Right.
Right.
But then what's left of the mountains?
Exactly. They can't keep up with the amount of people they want to climb it.
We kill ourselves going down in
space.
Yes.
Recently in California, they've had amazing waves, 25 feet, which is not normal for mavericks up by San Francisco. And so all the idiot surfers are like, oh boy, cowabunga, let's go. We got 20, and several people have died in the last week because they can't not do it. They see these 25 to 30 foot waves, and I got to do that.
Yeah.
And they get out there, they interview this lady. She's tough, I mean, she's just... I'm just thinking, I need a 30-foot wave, and I'm going to be in the zone. And, you know, people are dying out here in the waves. But like you said, who would want to go climb a mountain? I mean, forget it.
Well, there's many like that are below 8,000 meters, you know, that are like much safer.
They might live through it.
And prettier, like, but yeah, they have to do those. Like.
Hopefully they don't blow up anymore.
They could also blow up, yes, some are like volcanoes, I think. Yeah, and it's like, there's this great French word, which is also used in the English language, it's like ennui, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, which is that like, I'm sure Dandekesh has heard of it, ennui. It's that like, the doldrum of material existence, that like day in, day out, it's the ennui, material existence, it makes us try to... have some higher experience, right? That's why they try to climb these mountains. And, like the lady was saying, she wants to be in the zone. I have to try to escape this like doldrums of material existence. Yes. They're like looking for that. They're looking for that. Yeah. Yeah, and so many of those who have summited those mountains are like, I'm so happy, you know, they're like, I finally found, like, happiness. And many deaths happen, like, on the descent, you know, and there's somebody ever, like, they made those videos of themselves and then they died on the descent. Grandchild Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Thank you for your attention.